This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The chapter 5, chapter Hey, and the Ramban that we're doing is on verse 20 on Pasuk Chof. But first we'll look at a medrash, and what we're dealing with today is the apparent indignity of this whole parasha. And it's not a very nice parasha. And particularly for the woman, it appears to be an undignified process. And we need to understand why. What is Hashem's intention? Why is this parasha included? And what is it meant to achieve? Now listen to the medrash. Before looking at the medrash, look at verse 16. Ve'ikriv oiso ha-kohen, that's Pasuk Tet Zayin, and the kohen will bring her near, ve'he'emido lifnei Hashem, and will stand her before Hashem, ve'lokach ha-kohen mayim kedushim b'kli choret, and the kohen will take holy water in a earthenware utensil. So notice that the utensil is not a metal utensil. The utensil is made from earthenware, from earth. Min he'ofor asher yiyeh b'karka ha-mishkan, and from the dust that is on the floor of the Mishkan, yikach ha-kohen, the kohen shall take, v'nosan el ha-moim, and he shall add into the water from the dust of the floor of the Mishkan. Now the Medrash says the following: Mipnei mo omro toiro havei ofar l'soito. Why does the Torah say, bring dust into the water of the soita? What is the role of the dust? No, answers the Medrash. Zochso, because if she comes out clean from this process, yotze mimeno bein ka Avraham Avinu, she will have a son as great as Avraham. As it says about Abraham, remember when Abraham was arguing with Hashem, he said, who am I to be arguing with you? I am only dust. So Abraham was the first person who used that phrase, that I am dust, who acknowledged the limitations of the human being and saw himself just as dust. And a person as great as that will come from this woman if she is married. If she merits a loizokso, if she doesn't merit, tachzor la'ofro, she will return to the dust. So dust is something that has within it an image of enormous potential. The human being is created from sand, and the image of complete loss of potential, of death. And that's what the image of sand is. Sand is something that itself is sterile, and yet in sand we plant life. Life has this double image. And we put sand into the water so as to convey that image that potentially, if she's a pure woman, she will have children as great as Abraham, but if she's not, she'll die and she'll return to dust. Now the Medrash goes on to say the following: Bishar she'omar Avraham Avinu v'anuchi ofar vo'efer, because Abraham said, I am dust, zochu bonov, his sons had the merit, l'shtei mitzvahs, for two mitzvahs, efer poro v'ofar soito, the ash of the red heifer, and the dust of the soita. Now there are a few things we have to understand with this medrash. Firstly, what is the connection between the dust of the soita and the sand and the ashes of the korah? And secondly, what is the connection between that and Avraham saying, I am Ofar Eifer? And then the third question, what is the third question, the most important question of all? The third question is that this implies that the soita process is a great privilege, isn't it? It says, as a result of Avraham saying, I am merely dust and ashes, Zochu Bonov, his children had the privilege of two mitzvahs, the mitzvah of the Paraduma and the mitzvah of soita. So what we've got to try and understand is how the Medrash sees this parasha as a privilege, as a mitzvah. What is the positive of this that is so great that we only got this because Avraham said, Va'anuchi ofar ve'efer? Firstly, what is the connection between the Pora Aduma and the Soita process? That's where the we'll start to find the clues of understanding. Well, in what way are those two mitzvahs connected?
The other side of it,
yeah.
You have to be purified by the
family
and the red heifer.
Yeah,
and
but
the woman
has to be
sacrificed.
Yeah, but I think we can do better than that. What are the similarities?
It gives you a chance
to know your innocence.
So,
could
have the opportunity.
So, how does that tie to the
paradigma? The paradigma, that's what I was thinking.
What you're saying is very good, but we're going to come to that just a little bit later. But what's the connection between the paradigma?
The animal goes down, and he sacrifices his life. The animal does. Anything about you, I don't know.
What are the processes? Focus on the processes. What is. What is simply the intention of the process in the case of Paraduma and the case of
Sikh? Why do you think against me? I can't remember. Well, you Paraduma, is that a sacrifice of giving up like a hoju session?
Paraduma is that when a person has become. The reason we can't go into the Mokum Beis HaMikdash today, we can't go into the Mosque of Omar, is because we are Tameim. We've all come into contact with dead bodies and things, we've been in cemeteries and things like that. And the only way we could be cleansed to be able to do that is through the Paraduma process. So the Paraduma, the red heifer, used to be slaughtered and then it used to be burnt on the Mizbeach, and the ashes were mixed with water, and that water had to be sprinkled on a person, and then he was cleansed.
That was the process of getting
cleansed from Tumma, getting cleansed out of Tumma Samet. Right. What is the similarity between that and the and so?
The problem is that they're both being purified.
Okay, very good. So what is that? They're both the cleansing process.
Right.
So that means that the first shift we've got to make is not seeing this as some kind of punishment or public exposure. What we're looking at is a cleansing process. It's like going to the mikveh. It's actually a cleansing process. So we've got to ask ourselves, what is she being cleansed of if she didn't do anything? Don't forget, not every soitzer who comes has done anything. What in fact is she being cleansed of? But before we do that, let's understand the connection between Avraham. Avraham said, I am merely dust and ashes, says the Medrash. Because of that, we have the privilege of two mitzvahs, the cleansing process of the Paraduma and this is the Sota process. What is the connection between I am dust and ashes and these two processes, other than that they use dust and ashes? Paraduma uses ash and the Sota uses dust. But apart from that, what is the connection there? Why does the Medrash say, because of this, we got that? Because Avraham said, Afar Va'efer, we got Soito and Paraduma.
Because of how material
by doing what? Yes, but by doing what?
By acknowledging that he is.
Absolutely right. An acknowledgement of limitation. Right? For Avraham to say, I am merely Afar Va'efer. That's a hard thing for the human beings to say. Human beings don't normally say that. What do human beings normally say? The wonder of the human being and the power of the human being and the greatness of the human being. You won't often. And the only person who really talks about the limitations of the human being is Darwin, and he got into some trouble for it, didn't he? Darwin's a rigid animal. But most other people don't say that. And going to a bookstore and read about the books that are being published about people, they don't say people are nothing but dust, inanimate and useless and incompetent. That's not the message that we give out about ourselves. We like to talk about the human potential, about the greatness of the human being, about the capacity to create and to achieve and all of those things. For the human being to acknowledge his weakness as a race or as an individual is incredibly difficult. Now, acknowledging weakness is okay, and it's relatively easy when we do it as an excuse for non-performance kind of thing. Now, I can't do this, I'm just a so-and-so. Then we find we use it for an excuse, but to acknowledge weakness, not to acknowledge limitation in strength, not in weakness. And Avraham, what was Avraham doing when he said, "Anichi Afar"? What event was that? Remember that when Avraham said, "I am dust and ashes"? When was that? I think what we're going to have to do is teach in the community is going through the parasha every Shabbos. The ladies don't do that, do they? And the practice is read through the parasha in English. Just know what the Chumash says. Shabbos take the Chumash and read the parasha from beginning to end. Every single Shabbos. And after a few years, you'll know the Chumash well. Because these are things that are our cultures and our history. We should, well, for ladies who've been involved in Yiddishkeit for a while already, these are things you should be absolutely familiar with. Just by practice of reading through it. This is not, you don't have to go to Shirim for this. It's just to read the parasha every Shabbos.
What was the question?
What were the circumstances when Avraham said, "I am dust and ashes"? What was the circumstance? When did he say?
Asked him to do something when he gave it over to Aaron.
No. When did he say, "I am dust and ashes"? When he was arguing for Saddam. And he said, if there were 50 people, 40 people, 30 people, and then he said to God, "You must excuse me, I shouldn't really be arguing with you. I am nothing but dust and ashes." So when does he say that? He doesn't say that when he's miserable and sick and dying. He says that when he's arguing with Hashem. So when a human being is at his greatest to be able to say, "But I have limitations," that's difficult. That's difficult for the human being as a species, but it's particularly difficult for an individual. And what is the first part of the cleansing process? And that's why he said the first part of the cleansing process is acknowledging the weakness. I did wrong. I'm inadequate in this area. Until one is willing to acknowledge the inadequacy, the cleansing process cannot begin. What's the first thing we do for Yom Kippur, for Teshuvah? What's the first step in the process of Teshuvah? Is bidui, confession. To actually say, "I did it. I did something I shouldn't have done." So to acknowledge the wrong of the action and the fact that I did it is one of the hardest steps for the human being in the process of cleansing. And cleansing cannot begin until one is willing to do that. And so by Avraham being able to say Va'anochi Ofer Va'efer, he opened the way for all of humanity, certainly for us Jews, Jewish people, to be able to say, "I am nothing but," to be able to acknowledge weakness, to be able to accept that. As a result of that, God gives us two rewards that enable cleansing. The one is the Parah Aduma, and the other one is Sozin. So the Parah Aduma, we understand how that works. A person has come into contact with a dead body, he becomes spiritually defiled in that sense. The water of the Parah Aduma is sprinkled over him. He goes to the mikveh and all the rest of it, and he becomes Torah. That's a cleansing process. What is the Sozin being cleansed from? In this case, from suspicion, from mistrust. Because mistrust is one of the things that, in fact, you can't get this. It's one of the most damaging emotions that there can possibly be, because there's actually no way out. Once there's mistrust, there's no way that you can actually get it right, because whatever you'll say to the other person, they won't believe. And depending on the level of the mistrust, so is the difficulty of dealing with it. So the mistrust is a process from which the human being has no capacity to cleanse himself. And that's the damage and the danger of mistrust. And therefore, the Medrash says, this is a reward. This is an unbelievable opportunity. Now, we'll come back to it in a moment, but let's first do the Ramban. So, Sharon, you're the only one with a Ramban here.
Cleansing is the only way to...
Well, we'll see what the method is to remove the mistrust here. So it's verse 20. It's Pasuk Chof in the Ramban, and it's a few lines after the beginning of the Ramban. But I don't think any of the other Chumashim have the Ramban in it. Have you got that? Have you got Pasuk Chof? A few lines after the beginning, you should find one that says Vehinei Ein Bechol Mishpatei HaTorah. Can you see it? That's where we start. Vehinei and behold. Ein b'chol mishpatei haTorah. There is nothing in all the laws of the Torah. Dover toloi b'nes. A law that depends on a miracle. If this happens, then you do this. If this happens, then you do this. Miracles don't come into the area of halacha at all. Zulati ha'inyan hazeh, with the exception of this. Shivu pele b'nes kavua, which is an amazing miracle. Shiyaseh b'Yisrael, that occurs among the Jewish people. B'heyoysom Rubom Oisim Ratzon Shomokom, provided the majority of the Jewish people are tzaddikim. So this process will not work when the majority of the Jewish people are not doing God's will. So again, the Ramban is reinforcing this principle of the Medrash, that this is a privilege, this is not a punishment, this is an awful thing. This is something that in fact only works when we're on a level to merit it. Why? He chofet lamasitko liyaser hanoshim shelo teaseno kazois yeser ramim. There are a few advantages that come out of this. The one is a punishment for women who have been unfaithful, so as to discourage other women from doing that. With a nakos yisroel mina manzeros, that cleanses the Jewish people from manzeros. Shiyuruim lashroshkin of the sochov, so that God's presence can rest among the Jewish people. And that if people are having relationships across family lines, then God's shchino cannot rest here. Ulefichach posak ha'inyan hazeh mishor shenizkalkulu ba'averos, and therefore this stopped working when Jewish people started transgressing. This process no longer works. Kamoshe Omru, as it says, Mishira, and certainly where the husband, this ties in, Laurie's what we were discussing last week, Ramban makes very clear, Mishira, Buhanoafim, when the husband started misbehaving themselves, this process stopped entirely. This only works if the men are pure, and the nation generally is pure, and there's one woman, or an occasional woman, who is suspected of having moved outside of those rules, then this will work.
Can you just add how many of them were purified again?
No, we don't know. a little bit further in the Ramban, the Ein Hakosuv Omer Shtiyena Hanoshim Anafus Baturus Min Haoven Bavush Baaleim Naafi. This does not imply that if the husbands are misbehaving, the women are guiltless if they do the same. God forbid, Chasusho, not at all. All that it says is that the husbands or the nation generally are on a low level, this great miracle won't happen for the women. So how is the Ramban understanding this process with the Sotah? This is a gift to women. This is given for their honor. To establish a holy nation. And they do not understand this goodness and do not desire it. So when the nation doesn't desire it and doesn't value this mitzvah, it doesn't work. It only works when the nation values it. Now, why is it such a gift? Why is it so precious? We see that both in the Medrash and in the Ramban, that this was a gift given to the Jewish people for the honor and dignity of the women. And what we've explained is that when there's mistrust, there is no way to salvage it. And that's why this is the only mitzvah that works on a miracle. The only time that this can, the only thing that can salvage it, is if there's a proved miracle. There can be no human evidence that will satisfy it. Question of mistrust. So all that can happen is if God gives evidence. If God says, you are unfairly mistrusting this person has done nothing wrong. That's the only kind of thing that helps mistrust. And here God has come to the aid of the woman, of the mistrusted woman, and has said, I will testify for you. I will give evidence. I will remove the mistrust. But the downside, of course, is that if you haven't behaved yourself, it's going to blow. I can't give evidence if you're not pure, obviously. So the woman is taking the risk. The woman is having, it's not a question of a risk. If she knows she's pure, then there's no risk. And if she isn't, there's enormous risk. But if it wouldn't work that way, if there wouldn't be the clear indication of right and wrong in this process, there's no way that it could eradicate the mistrust. This process that allows the relationship to re-establish itself despite the mistrust. And the problem with mistrust is that it can be caused. How can mistrust be caused? What are the things that can cause that can damage trust?
Proof
is
something.
No, proof is not trust. Proof is not mistrust. There's proof. Well, the one is certain actions that are mistrustful, even though they might not be wrong, but they inspire mistrust. So if she went off spending quiet time with this particular person, that inspires mistrust. And that's why the laws of Yichud and so on are so important. The laws of Yichud are not because we're afraid that they may have a relationship. That's not the issue. The issue is to make it and to remove the possibility of mistrust, because once there's mistrust, what do you do? How do you solve it unless you have a social person? So mistrust can occur because of an action that causes mistrust. All mistrust can sometimes occur because a person is just a mistrustful person. A person is paranoid. So you can find situations of lack of trust creeping into relationships where there's total innocence. And sometimes it's not total innocence, but it's not that the person isn't guilty of what they're accused of being guilty of. And sometimes, of course, there is guilt. How do you deal with it? How do you resolve it? It's always there. It's always present. Unless Hashem himself steps in. And the only time in the whole Torah that Hashem is willing to step in is to salvage a woman from unfair mistrust. That's the only time that he's willing to do that. If the man is mistrusted by the woman, isn't such a process.
So
it was a gift to her. That's why the Ramban says women don't understand what a precious gift this is. That they have the opportunity through Sota, when the nation is on a high enough level, to be able to cleanse. That's why it's like for women. There is a cleansing process. There's an ability, there's a process in place to be able to do it. Now, coming back to what we said on last Friday, the only thing that one could say possibly is that, and that wouldn't work today, but it might have worked more in the time of the Torah, that a woman could allow herself to live with the mistrust more easily than the man. The man thinks that there's a possibility, we're not talking about knowledge, if there's knowledge then it's bad on both sides, but if a man thinks, who knows whether my wife has been faithful, that's the end of the marriage. If a woman says, who knows if my husband has been messing around, the 90% mistake in a marriage is probably have that level of mistrust. And it's a horrible thing because you don't know. But it doesn't destroy the marriage. But in the case of the woman, it does destroy the marriage. And for the reason, for the man.
That a woman can live with.
A woman can more easily, or certainly
today
in those times, could more
Torah.
Easily. In the time of the Torah for sure, and I think even today. The fact is that there are probably many women who are not 100% sure about the fidelity of their husbands. That there are not many men who are not sure about the fidelity of their women and stay in the marriage. That doesn't mean it's right or wrong, that's not the issue. It's just the capacity, because of the reasons we discussed last Friday, that there's an easier ability to live with it in the one case than there is with the other. And therefore, in the case of the woman, this wasn't able to be clarified absolutely. This would destroy families without a question. There's no way that the family could live with that kind of suspicion. Now the other interesting point is there are two things that we do in the process that are for quite strange reasons. The one is verse 18 in this Yudches. The Hamid HaKohen is HaYisho Lifnei Hashem, and the woman places the Kohen places the woman before Hashem, before Rais Roisho Yisho, and he removes her head covering. V'nosan al kapeho es minchas hazikoroin minchas kenosi. And he places on her hand the offering. So she now holds it. And then he busies himself and he goes and he gets the sand and he gets the water and he mixes the sand and the water and he does this and he does that. And she's there with the holding the sacrifice, which was heavy. It was very heavy. So put yourself in her situation. Now there are tables, you could put it down over there. She stretches out her hands, you put this big earthenware utensil with flour and water and things on it, so it's dough, it's heavy, and then he starts getting busy and he takes his time. And it's getting heavier and heavier and heavier for him. Why? Says the Medrash, what's the reason for that? Abba Hanan omer mishum Rabbi Lezer, Abba Hanan says because in the name of Rabbi Lezer, mipnei leyag'o, to make her tired. Why do we want to make her tired? Because we hope that she might admit before we go through the process, and that will save her life. But she might just getting so much. How much longer do I have to? All right, I did it. Now what? So we try and pressure her around. If she admitted it, she wouldn't have to drink the water. She wouldn't die. She'd have to divorce her husband and all of that kind of stuff. But at least she could save her life.
Why would she go through go through all these pains and hoping that maybe the reason why will be false and she'll get by with a lie?
And she knows she won't, because she's seen before, and that this was well known that this used to work. So she knows she won't get by. So you
are. Yes.
So it was well known that it works. What on earth would be in her head that we have to go to such levels to get her to admit? Why is it so hard? There's another thing that we do. We bring her before the Beis Din. But which Beis Din? We bring her before the Beis Din HaGadol, that means 71, the Sanhedrin. And the Gemara asks, what does she have to do with the Sanhedrin? Why do you need the Sanhedrin there? What is the role of the Sanhedrin? This is between the Kohen and the woman. There's nobody else who has a role in this. This is a sacrifice. This has nothing to do with the court of law. And imagine what it was like coming before the Sanhedrin. 71 of the Gedolei Yisrael, 71 of Moshe Feinstein sitting along in one big long bench, and here this poor little woman standing in front of these 70. Now they spring them in front of them, and then they take her off. There's not even a dialogue. What's the reason? Says the Gemara, just to scare her. Just so that if she's done it, she might just say, I don't need this in my life. Yes, I did it. Okay, now what? So the question is, why? That's the question. Why do you need to go to such lengths to scare her to admit to something she did when she knows that by not admitting to it, she will die? Most everybody will know in any case she's going to die a horrible death, a painful death, and a public death. Why not admit it? You see from there how hard admission is for the human being to admit, even if he knows that the consequence of not admitting could be death or will be death. It's still very hard for a human being to say, I did it, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. Apology, you know how hard apology is? It is to say it in a factory sort of a way. But to really say it in a way that to go to somebody else and say, you know, I did this, I was wrong, I must have hurt you doing it, I'm sorry I did it, I didn't intend to hurt you in that way, and I would like you to forgive me. Very, very hard to get those words out of your mouth. Why? Why is it so hard?
It's the whole process. How
makes
me why a woman would go through this?
Because she doesn't want to admit. She just doesn't want to say it, because it's hard to admit, it's just hard to say, I did it. Very, very, very hard. Had Nixon said, I did it, what would have happened? He would have stayed in office. Had Clinton said, I did it, what would have happened? They would have forgotten about it a week later. It would have been so easy. It would have been so quick.
So you're saying they gave them many opportunities along the way?
Not just opportunities, they made her tired, they threatened her, they put her in all sorts of situations to try and bring her to a point of admitting, so that she wouldn't have to die. And the Gemara learns from this, Medrash brings it, and you see how God's love for people, that even somebody who has done wrong, God goes out of his way to try and save. How much more so somebody who hasn't done wrong? And even this person has done a terrible thing, it's a kind of a capital offense, but nevertheless God tries to save her, take her before the Sanhedrin, tire her out, do whatever you can to try and help her admit, because if she admits she won't die. So what God is interested in is not that this takes place. The whole process of the sota is designed to bring her to admission if she did it, and to cleanse her if she didn't. That's the process, not to kill her. The desire is to clarify, to force an admission so that the husband knows if she doesn't admit and she goes through and she's cleared, there's no mistrust, it's finished, it's over. And that would be the end of the story as far as that's concerned. But you see the difficulty in that admission. Complete impossibility. So what does a human being need? What is missing in the human being that makes it so hard? Because it's quite irrational not to be able to admit, isn't that right? Did something wrong, the easiest thing is to apologize. Once you've apologized, it's over. So rationally, the easiest thing and the most logical thing for a person to do when they've done something wrong is admit, fix it, and get on. And yet we don't do it. What screw is loose? Why do we find it so hard? What's missing in our makeup that makes it so hard? What would we need in our minds to be able to fully deal with the ability, with ease, to be able to apologize? Lack of arrogance. And where do we see that for the first time? Where was that given to us? Abraham saying, I'm nothing, our father is, isn't that so? But by Abraham saying, I am nothing but dust, he enables us as human beings to look at our weaknesses. Not a terrible thing that you did wrong. What are you at the end of the day? You're a human being. You're a human being with that is weak. It's not the end of the world. If you really believe that human beings are infallible and great, that you as an individual are infallible and great, then of course you can't apologize. So the essence of apology is understanding Avraham's admission that I am dust and ash. And that's why the Medrash says it's as a result of Avraham's admission that we could have such mitzvahs. Because if the human being was incapable of acknowledging a sin, Sotah wouldn't work. The whole purpose of Sotah is to bring the woman to acknowledging that she's done wrong. How does she do that? Because she knows, Anachi Afave, all she has to say is, Anachi Afave, Efer. That's what she should say. You know what? I'm a human being. And I have passions, and I have desires, and I should have controlled those passions and desires, but I didn't. I did wrong. But you can only say that if you say, Anachi Afave, Efer. You can only say that if you're willing to say, I am just a human being. So I am the greatest human being, then it is. There's another thing about Ofar Ve'efer, about dust and ash, and that is that when you look at sand, you don't distinguish the grains. When you look at dust, you don't distinguish the grains. It's not that they're big grains, little grains, it's sand. When you say Anochi Afar Ve'efer, what are you saying? I'm not a great human being. I'm just one. I'm just a person. And I have the same weaknesses that humanity has. The fact that in some areas I've developed talents and greatness, that's one thing. But in terms of my weaknesses, I'm a human being like any other human being. That's the first step in the process of apology. There's no way that one can acknowledge a wrong without the acknowledgement of Anachi Afarbaev. That was the gift that Abraham gave us, the ability to look at ourselves as sand and dust. And God's reward for that is Torah Aduma and so on. If you have that capacity, then here's the cleansing process. And that's what Paradum is, a gift to the Jewish, that's what Soto is, a gift to the Jewish people to be able to allow a woman to cleanse herself from mistrust in a way that completely puts her beyond any kind of suspicion and results once again in her capacity to give birth to the most wonderful children, the most wonderful family situation, which the Major says is the outcome of the success of this process. Any questions on that? That brings us to the end of the session. I'm not sure whether he can do that. He probably can, you're probably right. But he could pull out earlier. Say, there's no need to go in. There's no need. I know my wife, I know that in front of the Sanhedrin she would have admitted. He might have that opportunity, I'm not 100% sure.
Well,
we know that the stoning of his children, there's some kind of a thing when you have a bad child, or I don't know the exact thing, but it never happened, or it has once every 7 years.
I can't understand why there's no information that has come in this world that
I'm
uncommon.
I don't know that, I just don't know the information. I'm not sure if it's mentioned
in
the
Gemara's
somewhere
as
to how.
You would think that his children, instead of Abraham, that somehow would be mentioned somewhere.
It clearly took place. There were clearly cases, or there are type of cases, but how frequently it was, over what period of time, I don't know.
Does that answer my question? Do you know how every woman goes through this process? That's the question of infidelity?
And only if the husband wants to.
Only if the husband wants to. We don't know how popular that's my question. And was there anything that a man would go testing? Was there anything, any way a woman would say, my husband fooled around?
No, the only thing that would happen is that if she is guilty, and so is he, this process won't work. She'll come out okay.
Also, if he also...
If he's also been fooling around, this process won't work. This won't kill her.
But the water would know it. So maybe she's hoping the water goes all the way through. Oh, that's it. There's your ass.
Yes, and that's why the Ramban said, that's not to say that she's excused because he was messing around. That's no excuse for her. But this process won't work. This process only works when there's purity. When one individual has moved out of a society that is pure, out of a family that is pure, out of a relationship that is pure, and there is suspicion, then this process will work. No, it will not work if he is. If he hasn't been behaving, so it's a completely waste for him.
That's
why
there
aren't
that many women. I've said not that many women would do this, because I don't think the men were so good in those days.
No, the women were pretty good too. This is unusual. In those days, it's very unusual. Don't forget the sexes were very separated at those days. There wasn't even that much opportunity for it. Men and women didn't see each other that much. So it wasn't a problem then. Problem today.
You might have covered it in the way that you said last week that there was something about the vessel that made the water bitter.
No, I didn't. It wasn't that the vessel made the water the bitter. The bitterness was also miraculous. That took place in the time in the hands of the Kohen. It turned into bitter. What is important about the vessel is that that is the vessel, not the vessel that she holds, but the vessel that the water comes from, which is the kiur. The kiur was made from copper, and the copper was, you remember, made from the mirrors. Nice. Right, the fact that after all those years in Egypt, there was no case of infidelity or mamzerus, and the women are credited with that, and they used to use those mirrors in their relationship with their own husbands only. They used to go out of their way to make themselves attractive only for their own husbands, and the outcome of that was that the kiur was regarded as one of the most holy of the kelim of the Mishkan, and was used specifically for that. So that the very material that the women used to beautify themselves, and what's important over here is that the act of the woman beautifying herself is seen as an act of kedusha. The process of dressing beautifully and making up beautifully and looking good, that's an act of kedusha. Where it becomes not an act of kedusha is when it's designed to attract the attention of other men. When it's designed for the husband-wife relationship, the outcome of that was the kiur, and that's why the kiur was used. So you as a woman are being accused of going against the very material from which this kiur was made. And that's why he removes her head covering as well. What is he saying? Jewish women cover their hair. Why do they do that? Because they realize that their attractiveness is part of their relationship with their own husband. You have gone in, or you are accused of going into a relationship beyond that, so why cover your hair? It's hypocritical. If that's what you are, take your hair covering off. Don't walk around with a shetel and try and attract other men. That's the message there.
But for the woman who didn't do it, she's going to end up being purified and have this wonderful child. She's also had to walk around with her head uncovered. Why did she have to go there?
She claims herself from suspicion. There's suspicion. There's no other way for her to cleanse herself from suspicion. It's a horrible thing. But the outcome is that we have a way of dealing with mistrust, that there is no other way of dealing with mistrust. Have they had most of the Torah?
There's
no
way to make it palatable for them. It's so hard for someone to use a feminist to really get
into
it. There's no way of explaining it.
Now, the first thing you've got to explain to a feminist is you've got to move her beyond feminism. You can't take it. It's like saying, you know, is there a way to explain to a deaf person what Beethoven's like? The first thing is you've got to cure the deafness. And feminism, I'm talking about feminism in its extreme form. I'm not talking about feminism for the dignity of the woman and the rights of the woman to education. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the real extreme feminism. You can't explain the Torah to a person whose beliefs are feminist. It's like explaining the Torah to an atheist. You can't explain Mount Sinai to an atheist. Of course, there's no way you can make Mount Sinai palpable to an atheist. First, you've got to deal with the atheism. So in that case, first, you have to deal with the feminism. And once the feminism is not so extreme, then it is probable, because one realizes these, and you ask the feminist very simply, what other way is there for dealing with mistrust? So she'll say, and what about the mistrust of men? So you'll look at the statistics and you'll say, how many women are living with men today that they do not fully trust? And the answer will be very, very high. How many men are living with women that they don't trust? The answer is low. So there are ways of dealing with it, but you can't deal with it. The problem with feminism is the closed-mindedness. The problem with a lot of liberal thinking is that it's the most intolerant. It's so ironic that liberalism, which is supposed to be the essence of tolerance, is the most intolerant of diverse viewpoints. I don't know, the most, I suppose, any extreme of the spectrum, extreme conservatives, are also intolerant of other viewpoints. You can only talk rationally with a person who is rational. We learned with the men in the Rambam this morning. No extreme is rational, and no extreme is good. Anybody who is on either extreme is closed. The only time you can have an open discussion with anybody is when they're somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. And they're willing to listen, to argue, to debate, to hear, even if they disagree. But if you're talking to somebody who's not even willing to hear, then you can't dialogue with that person. Right. No, there's a whole lot of mysticism in that. It's that, in fact, that gives the water that power. The fact that that water now contains God's name, and God's name would not be able to survive in the body of a woman who had done that. That's really, it's the incompatibility of the contents of that water with who that woman is if she's done what she says she hasn't done. So it's more than just a symbolic thing. It actually gives the water its mystical and miraculous power. That more than anything else. Never use it. And again, the Gemara says this is an example of how far God is willing to go to restore trust between a husband and wife. He's willing to have his own name wiped out. The result will be trust between husband and wife. But there's nothing with God. If God's willing to do that, then we would realize ourselves how much we must be willing to do that. But there is the willingness to dilute, to completely eradicate the self-being in order to establish trust. But that's what's really needed in order to re-establish trust. An interesting thing, and attractive is important, because one of the important elements of a woman appearing attractive is not just for her husband but for herself. A woman who doesn't feel attractive is not attractive to her husband. So even when the woman is in public, if she doesn't feel attractive, she's unlikely to be attractive to him. So there's quite a narrow line. What we're talking about is not being attractive, it's really the intention of the attractiveness, rather than looking unattractive when you're outside and attractive when you're inside. That doesn't really work. So it's really the intention. And that's why it's quite interesting, I think we mentioned it once before, the Muslim practice, where the women wear the most exotic and beautiful clothing under these things that they wander around with. They wear incredible jewelry, they're made up, and they wear the most exotic and erotic clothing. So they're walking around knowing they're gorgeous. And knowing that nobody else can see it, there's a whole eroticism even in that kind of a thing. But from a tzniut's point of view, it's fine. And the idea of tzniut is not to feel ugly, to feel unattractive, not at all. What happens if the man feels the same way? Likes to see men attracted to his wife.
Yeah,
well, then she should dress in a way that they are. That doesn't mean to dress in a way. One can dress within the confines of halacha that enable one to be stunningly attractive in public. It doesn't. It doesn't mean necessarily that. It needs sometimes a bit more creative capacity. Certainly for a woman who is naturally very beautiful, and usually very young, the easiest way to look attractive is to wear minimal clothing. But there's no reason that a woman, there's no law in the Torah that says a woman should not look attractive in public. There are laws of things, there are laws of covering, there are laws, those are the laws. So not only if a man, most men would like their wives to look attractive in public. Most men do not like that. It's a very insecure man that wants his wife to look unattractive in public. A secure man wants his wife to look attractive, but it doesn't have to be without sneers. One can look attractive with sneers as well. But that requires, there's quite an art in that dressing process. I want you to wear a backless, strapless, no shaitel. Shaitel should only be done as a husband and wife together. Okay, hair covering should only be done with a husband and wife together. Any hair covering, if the husband has a problem with a hair covering, whether it's shaitel or another hair covering, that problem should be resolved before the woman starts covering her hair. That is a marital issue that needs to be worked through, because it could damage the marriage, and it's not worth it. The husband and wife have to be at idem on that. It's really important. But if it takes a little longer, then so be it. That's not. that's how it comes. The rest of the tzniyos is lesser. Again, it'll be dependent. There are different levels of tzniyos. There is basic and non-negotiable tzniyos, and then there's the negotiable tzniyos.
Like what?
Non-negotiable tzniyos is upper arms, above the knees. There are certain things. But if a woman wants to wear a full length, and her husband said he doesn't mind if she wears a knee length, then that should be governed by the relationship, not by the woman. So that is the non-negotiable part of the tzniyos.